And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please get that pencil and recycled paper handy, and let's get right on into our commentary for this week. Our commentary is, Should We Protect Private Homes from Forest Fires? And it was written by William L. Baker of the Denver Post. In the last few years, there have been serious property-damaging fires in the West in what has been dubbed the urban-wildland interface, including large fires in Colorado, Montana, and recently near Jackson, Wyoming. Millions of dollars of property remain at risk of future fires, and federal land management policies have responded by allocating almost $2 billion to deal with the problem. But should public forest lands be altered and firefighters put at risk to protect nearby private property? Projects are proposed on public land in the Front Range of Colorado and other places to protect property on adjoining private land in the wildland-urban interface, primarily using thinning and fuel reduction. The public forest area that would be affected if every home on the interface is to be protected is potentially very large. But recent research suggests that thinning and fuel reduction may be at odds with the ecology of our forests and may also be rather futile. Our research group at the University of Wyoming has found that ponderosa pine forests in the Rocky Mountain National Park were naturally subject to periodic high-intensity crown fires during the centuries before settlement by Euro-Americans. That's basically all of us. Research by Dr. Thomas Veblen at the University of Colorado Boulder suggests that high-intensity fires may also have occurred before settlement throughout the ponderosa pine forests of the Front Range, except at the lowest elevations near the plains. High-intensity crown fires have long been known to be a natural occurrence at higher elevation forests in our region, but we now know them to be a natural part of the lower elevation forests as well. In fact, these fires are essential to maintaining a healthy forest ecosystem. We have been hearing that past fire suppression has created unnatural fuel conditions in our forests, and the remedy now is to thin these forests and lower the fuel loads. But this is really only known to be true in forests where crown fires were uncommon or absent historically. Thinning a forest naturally subject to high-intensity crown fires might also, in theory, prevent some crown fires from starting, but the actual evidence that this works is limited, particularly when fire weather is severe. More certain is that once started, crown fires typically spread with flames that can be 100 feet or more high. When these flames bend over under the force of strong winds, as we often have in the Front Range, they can easily cross large gaps, including those inside thinned forests. Under extreme fire weather conditions, as we have seen in some recent years and has occurred in times in the past, natural crown fires will occur in the forests of the Front Range wildland-urban interface. Even if thinning our Front Range forests really could lower the chance of natural crown fires, it is not restoration any more than flood control dam on a river is restoration. Employees of the federal agencies have a fine and honorable record of fighting fires with a remarkable dedication and willingness to take risks. But firefighters and public land managers can really do little more than stop some natural crown fires once started than weather forecasters can do to stop a major flood. Public land management is neither the source of the problem nor the source of the solutions, as our forests are naturally wild, hazardous places. We chose long ago to protect them from development and generally accept the hazards along with the benefits that come with protection. Only recently has development in this hazard zone near public lands created a problem. We now face a reckoning about public and private rights and responsibilities in the wildland-urban interface. Private property is a sacred American value, but conservation of our valuable public lands is also as American as flags, apple pie, and barbecues. It's time for private and public responsibilities in the interface zone to be recalculated. It is at best irresponsible to shunt the cost and burden of difficult fire protection for private property onto adjoining public lands, especially when this may be ineffective and require public forests to be altered from their natural condition. Shouldn't private citizens accept and personally manage their good share of the risk if they choose to build in dangerous locations near public forests? If houses in their immediate vicinity are fireproofed, see FireWise website at www.firewise.org for more information about that, then certainly we must include these houses in the shared community responsibility for fire protection. But if structures are not defensible, why should we have to put firefighters in harm's way? Why should there ever be an expectation that public forests will be altered to protect adjoining private property? Communities, county governments, insurance agencies, and concerned citizens can develop incentives and disincentives to reshape the balance of responsibility in the wildland-urban interface. There is nothing unusual about requiring development to be responsible. It is now common to ask developer to pay its own way in our towns and cities. For too long, we have ignored or miscalculated the cost of development in the wildland-urban interface. Now, the $2 billion National Fire Plan effectively shifts these costs to the public and to our forests. This plan needs to be redirected at the real need, which is helping us to say no to costly and irresponsible development that threatens public lands in the wildland-urban interface and that puts our firefighters at risk. This editorial was written by William L. Baker, who is an ecology professor at the Department of Geography and Recreation at the University of Wyoming and Laramie, and we thank him for his contribution. What do you have for us, Jason?
All right, boy and girl, from the InfoShop News, got proposed Anti-Terrorism Act 2001. What effect will this have? How about your privacy? Will allow a government search without serving warrant? Section 352 will waive requirements and that the law enforcement notify persons subject to search warrants. This will not be limited to terrorism, but will apply to all searches for that material that constitutes evidence of a criminal offense. This is a radical departure from the Fourth Amendment standards and could result in routine covert break-ins by law enforcement agents. Will grant government authority to bypass courts to subpoena information. Section 156 will allow investigators to issue subpoena for any items, including books, records, papers, documents, and other items deemed to be related to an intelligence operation. This will bypass court oversight, as access to specific records is currently allowed only upon a court order. Will allow the government unlimited access to electronic information. Section 107 will allow law enforcement and government agencies to bypass current requirements for access to records concerning electric communication service. Service providers will be forced to disclose all information, including personal information, dates, phone records, and type of services used. This will not limit to investigations of specific terrorist activity. Will allow military intelligence to investigate domestic cases. Grand jury proceedings are at this time required to be secret to protect uncharged witnesses or innocent victims. This will be changed to allow prosecutors to share secret testimony widely with law enforcement, intelligence, and military officials. Allowing military intelligence to investigate domestic criminal cases goes against long-standing rules in the United States of America. This will affect your free speech. Will expand the definition of terrorism to include minor offenses. The bill will greatly increase penalties for acts perceived to be terrorism. Breaking of a window or during a protest could be considered terrorism. The person could be charged with a federal crime and sentenced to life in prison. Here's your property rights. Will allow the government to take any property of an accused person. Government forfeiture powers will be expanded in criminal cases, including those not related to terrorism. The accused will not have to be convicted of any crime, and the property does not have to be obtained through criminal action. The government will be able to seize a person's home, car, and any other asset before providing that person to commit a crime. The Attorney General, under this provision, has carte blanche to decide that someone until he can be removed. Even if someone says he shouldn't be removed, he should stay in jail forever, with no evidence before a judge. Representative Gerald Nanner, congressional hearings on Homeland Defense, 925-01, here's your immigration. Will allow indefinite detainment. Section 202 states the Attorney General can decide to hold non-citizens indefinitely with no ability for persons to challenge the decision in court. Attorney General can do this with essentially no evidence. Evidentiary standards are so low as to make persons subject to whims of the Attorney General. Will allow retroactive prosecution. The bill will also retroactively make non-citizens deportable for providing material support for the unlawful activities of a terrorist organization. This is true even if the organization was not designed to be a terrorist organization and when the support was provided in provision of such support was entirely lawful when given. Under this law, a permanent resident could be deported today for making a donation to Nelson Mandela and the AMC because the group in the past engaged in military as well as nonviolent opposition to apartheid. A permanent resident could be deported for having provided such aid in the 1980s when thousands of Americans were doing the same thing when it was plainly lawful to do so. It's possible to say that had we had every one of these provisions, that we would have avoided the attack. We know that without provisions, we would not avoid the attack. Attorney General Ashcroft, congressional hearings on Homeland Defense. Here, boys and girls, got a good little poetry from you by Sue Silva Mary, American supporter of the RAWA. That's a liberation front for Afghani women down on the Afghani coast down the corner. It's based on part of testimony given by Sargwani Wazari at the Union Tribunal this December 98 on the eve of the 50th anniversary of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is The Ghosts of Afghanistan. When I couldn't breathe, when I lifted a corner of the heavy barouka, when I exposed my mouth and nose desperate to gulp air, they beat me unconscious. When they beat us again with whips and metal cables, while I waited in the hospital, when the sick babies in their mother's arms fell to the floor, my will to live began to tremble. In the summer of 96 we laughed. I can't remember the sound. Before that September, when the Taliban came, we were no different than you. Now we are the ghosts of Afghanistan, the women and girls of a whole country under house arrest. For trying to go to work, my sister was beaten. For leaving her home alone, my neighbor was tortured. For showing her ankle as she rode behind her husband on a bike, my girlfriend was shot dead on the street. My children are shrinking before my eyes, but I am banned from receiving food from the World Food Program. In the orphanage are girls who have never seen the sun or trees. My sons are being taught a man should beat a female who is seen, even though the windows of a home are a bus. I view the world through a patch of mesh, in voluminous tents that pull me stooping. The garment gains me, takes mobility and voice. When the barka descends over my tender head, I am invisible, a living woman who can't be seen or heard. My woman's will to live can only strengthen. I die to die and live to live. If I could only live a noble life.
And thank you, Jason. Let's move back to Brazil. A Brazilian activist has been murdered by capitalists. The Amazon populist killing exposes bitter conflicts in this story by Larry Roeder. A lot of people here wanted Ademir Federici dead, and some of them did not hesitate to say so, but up and down the length of the Trans-Amazon Highway, the question being asked is this: who actually killed Mr. Federici, the region's most outspoken labor peasant and environmental leader? Perhaps not since the murder of Chico Mendes, the rubber tappers advocate, in 1988, has a single death caused such an uproar in the Amazon. One of seven leaders of regional labor, religious, or environmental groups who have been killed since July, Mr. Federici was the director of the Movement for the Development of the Trans-Amazon and the Xingu when he was shot here in August in front of his wife and four children. According to his associates, Mr. Federici, 42, had been in fear of his life ever since a wealthy logger here told him about 18 months ago that it was time for him to buy some wood for his own coffin. That threat came after Mr. Federici reported to the federal police that the logger was illegally chopping down trees on an Indian reservation. The official version of Mr. Federici's death is that he was killed during a home invasion after catching a thief trying to steal his television at 1:30 in the morning. But his widow, Maria de Penofehu Federici, 34, vehemently denies that account. "The killers didn't even touch the television," she says, "but went straight into our bedroom, and when I screamed that someone had come in, Dema awoke, struggled with the intruder, and was shot by someone standing outside the window. No, everything leads me to believe that this was a contract killing, and I want the real killer to be found." Mr. Federici, known here as Dema, had an tangled with a gang of hijackers and car thieves operating on the Trans-Amazon Highway, and was leading the opposition to a dam project the Brazilian government wants to build here. More recently, he has also denounced corruption in the Superintendency for the Development of the Amazon, or SUDAM, the government agency set up to channel money to worthy construction projects, but which has often favored wealthy ranching, logging, and mining interests. For many years, SUDAM was controlled by Jader Barrio, who was the governor of the state of Pará and its senator. The agency was abolished earlier this year after a wave of news reports indicating that he had built a personal fortune of more than $10 million in fraudulent dealings with SUDAM. Mr. Barrio was forced to resign this month. At first glance, Mr. Federici might have seemed an unlikely candidate to challenge the establishment. Born in the southern state of Paraná, he moved to the Amazon with his family in the early 1970s, drawn by the government's promise of land without men for men without land. settling on a farm just off the new highway in Medicilandia, 80 miles west. As an adult, he continued to cling to the land, growing cocoa and coffee on a 125-acre lot on which he had built his own house. But his eloquence and charisma gradually propelled him to the top of the regional peasant movement, and in July, a month before his death, his family moved here to be closer to the center of what he called the struggle. Speaking of her husband, Mrs. Federici said, "I have never known a person with more of a knack for understanding complicated things and explaining them in a simple fashion. He was a fighter for the forest and the rights of the ordinary people of this region, and God knows there is plenty to fight about." After a two-year respite, largely the result of a national economic crisis, the destruction of the Amazon seems to be headed back toward the record levels of the mid-1990s. The current dry season, which will end in a month, has been one of the most parched on record. This has made it easier for ranchers and loggers to burn or fell large areas of forest for their businesses. This ramshackle town of 77,000 people is at the junction of the Xingu River and the Trans-Amazon Highway, an agricultural frontier region in which conflicts over land are common and often violent. "It's the Wild West around here," said Marcio Arujo, an official of the Human Rights Commission for the Brazilian Congress, which sent a delegation here this week. The main headline in the local weekly paper, for instance, announces that in Atatuba, west of here on the Trans-Amazon Highway, the mayor was threatened by six aldermen with death. Out in the countryside, most settlers are armed with pistols or rifles and not just to hunt game. Even those disposed to settling such disputes by legal means find it hard to do so here. Altamira is the seat of the largest municipality in Brazil, but it is currently without judges who tend to demand transfers just as soon as they receive their first death threat and has no permanent resident prosecutor to handle growing backlog of cases. After the killing, local authorities, who are allied with Mr. Barvalho and other powerful business interests, quickly arrested a petty thief who had been seen hanging around Mr. Federici's office the day before his death. That enabled a special investigator sent from the state capital 460 miles away to pronounce the case closed and return home. Imagine, in less than 48 hours, working without proper forensic equipment and on the basis of just a couple of interviews, they managed to solve this crime, Bruno Kempner, Mr. Federici's successor's coordinator of the development group, said. That has got to be some kind of record for Brazil. Efforts by Mr. Federici's associates to get the case reopened and to be allowed to present new evidence have thus far failed, but this case has caught the attention of human rights groups and opposition political parties who are threatening to make it a cause célèbre. I have profound doubts that Mr. Dima's death occurred the way that it is presented in the official documents, Nelson Pellegrino, chairman of the Human Rights Commission of the lower house of the Brazilian Congress, said in a hearing. He said he would argue that the Justice Ministry to bring in the federal police to assure that we can have a satisfactory investigation of this case. As the uncertainty over his death lingers, Mr. Federici is quickly becoming a martyr to the environmental cause. A poster circulating in the region shows him, microphone in hand, asking, "Why must capitalist power sink its claws here into this wonder of nature?" And bumper stickers with the phrase, "Dima, your life continues in our struggle," are also being distributed. But a death list with 25 names on it, all of them opponents of local business interests, is also circulating. José Geraldo Torres, a member of the Workers' Party who represents this area in the Pará State Legislature, said he had received several death threats recently, including one relayed from a prominent logger with whom he had been at odds. "He was traveling on a plane with a friend of mine," Mr. Torres recalled, "and in front of all the passengers," he said, "you tell José Geraldo that if my land title gets canceled, I will cancel him." And in this story from BrazilIndieMedia.org, and we want to thank Indie Media for being right there. What have you got for us there,
got Jason? A good little pick-me-up here. After all that stuff on September 11th, people have been coming together in Union Square. This is another information from that info source I had earlier, the Info Shop News. You can find them out there. And that poem you can also find about from Afghan women at the Rawa, R-A-W-A. I didn't print out the full thing.
I believe that's it's resistance by the Afghan Women's
resistance against
Afghan Women's Association. Yeah.
Well, it's also a resistance movement too.
Yeah.
where the women are coming together and, you know, all being wrapped up and you gotta wear all this clothes and no one can see like an ankle or anything. Pretty wild. They shouldn't watch American TV. It's bad. No, it's not bad.
TV in Afghanistan was banned about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
They completely stopped all television broadcasts. They've been breaking television sets. It's
they're only a size
probably
of
a good thing.
I don't know. You know, I'd dig ESPN, you know, Comedy Central, good cartoon channels, you know, good stuff. All right, here's some information from Coming Together in Union Square. This is by Adina Shater and Sarah Yam. With Midtown Manhattan below 14th Street initially closed off to the public after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, people began to spontaneously gather in Union Square Park, the largest public space on the edge of the quote-unquote frozen zone. A patch of green and concrete that's normally an escape for lunchgoers and resting place for homeless people. The site of a popular green market in an area of trendy restaurants was transformed into a collectively memorial for the victims, as well as a place for New Yorkers to express their personal and political responses to the tragedy and its still uncertain aftermath. For the better part of 2 weeks, an incredibly disparate group of New Yorkers turned Union Square Park into something that was part Woodstock, part religious revival, part political rally, and part funeral, and to which all were welcome. The geography of this world quickly became established. The street kids colonized the center of the park. The Christians took over the east end of the square. The street musicians hung out on the southern steps with the activists handing out literature. And the visitors, coming by the thousands, milled through it all. Union Square did feel almost like an entire world unto itself, a microcosm of the larger nation's attempt to grapple with and understand the tragedy. From the time when Emma Goldman regularly spoke in the park in the 20s, Union Square, around the corner from the nation's current offices, has been a rallying spot for political and cultural radicals, where men and women have gathered to organize, to celebrate, and even, as after the execution of the Rosenbergs, to commemorate and grieve. The vigil this month was a continuation of older traditions, but in some ways something new. Previous gatherings never crossed political, racial, class, and gender lines in the way this vigil and the associated rallies have. The possibility that a real grassroots dialogue about war and violence could emerge, and with it a new and more inclusive sense of American identity. It is at least a slim hope to cling to in the wake of the terrorist attacks' horrors.
And that's about all the time we have, Jason. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. There's a little more left. Check out InfoShop News. They're pretty cool.
All right. And that's all the time we have tonight. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send regular letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That address again. Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send all announcements in at least 3 weeks in advance so we can get them on the air. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can also listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And there's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archived shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's radio. The number 4all.net, and search for Earth First Radio. This is show number 162. Earth First Radio is carrying on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, and please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in Mega Studio A at Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I want to thank Jason for help tonight. Thank you.
Righteous.
Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to a little bit more Robert Hoyt. This one's called quitting time.
Get excited about new inventions. I'm sure most were made with the best of intentions. Thought it was cool to put a man on the moon, but now I've begun to sing a different tune. Technology and science have become a religion, based on blind faith, not conscious decision. When answers cause the problems, it's time to stop and think. Slam on the brakes and make a U-turn from the brink. It's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. They try to tell us how hard it used to be, back when things tended towards simplicity. But our way of life is based on false pretenses, 'cause look at all the unintended consequences. It's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. By a way of life propped up by lies, but some of us have come see things through different eyes. Tomorrow there'll be more of us than there are today. We're that ragged, jagged, cutting edge, and we all say, it's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. It's quitting time, it's quitting time.